You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to CRM Archaeology Podcast episode 327. And joining today is Renee. Where are you, Renee?
I am currently in Farmington, New Mexico.
And if we hear anything in the background, she's monitoring drilling. And Doug from Scotland.
Hey, everyone.
And Andrew from Southern California.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
And I am traveling right now from the Central Coast down to Palm Springs. So thanks, everybody, for joining. Today, we are going to talk about technology primarily in CRM and the idea that, you know, we have lots of very cool tools in our tool chest and understanding that not all of them are, you know, applicable to the projects at hand, and that it's important to really understand when the technology that we have are useful for the project. And I think a lot of times in our business, not all the time, but a lot of times in our business, we don't always use the proper tools. And sometimes we use tools that really are not applicable to the project at hand. So understanding the technology behind them is important. I think the other aspect is that, you know, we have stakeholders that consult with the agencies that have some say in our work plans and how we study an area. And those stakeholders don't always understand when the technologies are applicable or useful for our projects. And our job as CRM professionals is to be able to really have a good grasp on these technologies and be able to consult with the agencies and hopefully steer it in the right direction. Now, we don't always have control. Sometimes we just have to do it, but, you know, we can talk a little bit about that probably in the third segment. But for this segment, I'd like to bring up a couple obvious ones, and then I'm hoping definitely that Andrew can talk about underwater archaeology, since that's his thing. But a couple obvious ones that people like to use a lot are GPR and forensic dogs. And I think it'd be good for us to understand what the limitations of GPR. I do a decent amount of ground penetrating radar surveys. And, you know, mainly the reason I do them is because I'm a human osteologist. And so, you know, we deal with cemeteries where we might have one or two marked graves, but we don't have. But obviously, you know, if we have a marked grave or a couple marked graves, there is definitely the potential of having more. And so, you know, GPR is very useful there, but a lot of times, at least I do, and I'd like to hear what you guys think, but I, or what your experiences are, I have seen, you know, agencies that just, sometimes it's tribes that are asking for it or other stakeholders that are asking for ground penetrating radar because they want to make sure that the project is looked at thoroughly without understanding what the limitations are to that technology. So, you know, ground penetrating radar is an awesome tool. Like I said, it's great for graves and being able to identify anomalies around, you know, known marked graves. Right now, we're actually dealing with a couple projects that have the potential for having a cemetery. They've popped up through the database searches. And, you know, one thing to remember is that just because you have a location of a cemetery doesn't mean that's where the cemetery is. Many times the location is marked within the database based on witness accounts, families, some research, genealogical sites that have said, okay, it's in this area, it's on this property. The person may have, you know, looked at the old parcel and said, okay, this was that family's land, and some, you know, information has said that it was generally in this location around the house or near, you know, far, like a couple hundred yards from the homestead or whatever, but you have no idea where the grave is, right, where the cemetery is. And so, you know, that's tough. GPR is not something that's really conducive to surveying acres and acres of land. It takes time and a lot of effort. And so, you know, really doing deep research first to see and exhaust all other options before doing GPR is important. A few other limitations are the soils. So, you know, ground penetrating radar doesn't work all that well when there's a lot of water in the soil or clay. And so, you know, understanding the soils that you're dealing with on the project site is important. Another is you can have lots of other anomalies that are in the area, tree roots and man-made features that are going to impact, I mean, like modern man-made features that are going to impact the readings. And that's something to understand. That's why, you know, obviously when you're doing the GPR survey, you need somebody who knows what they're doing. But before that decision is made, you need to have somebody who's consulting that knows what they're doing to determine whether or not the GPR even makes sense. So I've had agencies that have requested GPR thinking that cremains could be identified with GPR. And, you know, that's very challenging and not going to be very useful. There are other options for GPR, but, you know, then you have along the idea of graves, you have the forensic canine dogs. And, you know, I've had multiple surveys with canine dogs, and they were required by the agency. And it was, you know, it was challenging because it was the tribe that had asked for it. And they were, that area tended to cremate. Cremations were very popular. And we had one in particular where the cremains, we had the forensic dogs were surveying the area, and they actually alerted on multiple areas in the creek. And it turned out over time, over doing some research, so we found out that this area was used quite a bit by drug users, unfortunately, in amongst the trees, and somebody had died there with an overdose, right? So I'd like to talk a little bit more about the forensic canine dogs a little later, about some of the limitations with that. But for now, Doug, do you have something to say?
Yeah, it was just some comments on the GPR as well. Is it'll depend on what sort of antenna you're using. So I think if you're not too familiar with GPR, you don't actually realize that, like, you're scanning at different depths. So you either have to scan everything, which will be, you know, multiple courses across the same area, or you really do have to kind of have an idea of what you're looking for much more in advance. It's not, as you were saying, Heather, a great technology to let's just GPR several hundred acres and see what we find sort of tool. And also to add on that, so this is not an example from GPR, but resistivity. I remember we did a resistivity scan, but it's still applicable for GPR. I essentially went out to a field, and about two-thirds of the way through, we ended up hitting a tree, and then realizing the tree, the surface area, dropped down about 30 or 40 centimeters right around the tree, which was odd. But then what we figured out was basically there was a coal mine nearby, and they had essentially just used the field decades before to just drop waste. And so they'd added about, like, you know, 30 or 40 centimeters worth of essentially, you know, I guess you could call it industrial waste. It wasn't maybe what many people picture in their mind with industrial waste, but, you know, essentially a whole range of rock, unused coal, and essentially that killed whatever results there were, because essentially we were at the depth we were going and what we were penetrating, we were basically just going through waste. And if anyone had done a nice little desk-based assessment ahead of time, a little bit of research, they could have saved us like that.
Exactly.
Several days worth of work where they could have identified, ooh, hey, or even just like if someone had gone out and done a little bit of a recce and like looked around and just, you know, even an auger taking some soil samples just to double check before they started doing that, you know, for all these sort of remote sensing sort of things, they work, but they work under specific conditions. And you can't assume that you have those conditions without like first doing a little bit of work to determine that. So I'll just leave it at that. But it, I mean, that was resistivity, but it would still work for your GPR. You know, there's plenty of sites that you essentially end up with industrial layers that are going to mess up whatever it is that you find or think you're finding, unless you know ahead of time.
So, you know, something, again, just mentioning, a lot of these tools are requested by agencies or stakeholders during consultation, and then agencies require it. And it is, I think, our job as CRM professionals to educate the agency. And I've had that happen where I've had an agency say that they want a ground penetrating radar survey, and I've explained to them, you know, what the limitations are, and that in this case, it really is not going to be helpful. And, you know, we as consultants do have a responsibility to make sure that we're, you know, doing all we can to, in a reasonable sense, identify what might be there. But we also have, and the agency has a responsibility to the applicant to not require overly burdensome work that is not going to be fruitful. And so as consultants, it's up to you to really understand these technologies. Even if you cannot do a GPR survey yourself, you have to understand really when it's going to be useful and when it won't. And that is going to be on a, you know, on a project by project basis. And I think, you know, right now we're dealing with those cemeteries that I was saying, you know, we're doing a lot of research beforehand, genealogical research. We're looking through, we have a title search. We're looking through all of the, you know, the documents and files that we can find on that property. And it, this is way outside of the archaeological databases, so that we can understand, and maybe there's some kind of nugget in there. You know, if you look at a title search, there are lots of times there are descriptions specific to that property and the features that are on that property. And so exhausting on a research end is going to be much more reasonable approach before you go out with GPR. And again, just surveying, we have this one property with three cemeteries with just like a pin, they had to put the point somewhere in the database and you don't know where it is. You know, it's silly. So just like Doug said, doing acres and acres of GPR is a waste of the money, that because it could very likely not be fruitful and it's very expensive. With that, we will wrap up this segment and we'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 327. This is our second segment, and we are talking about technology, our technology toolbox for CRM, and as good consultants, understanding which tool to use at any one time is important and a responsible way of consulting. So, Doug.
Yeah, so for my tool I'm going to talk about is site predictive modeling. And I think a lot of the issues that people come away with that technology, those methods, is it might slightly oversell it with site predictive modeling. It's closer to site probability modeling would be a much better way of saying it. Yeah, because you end up with people who look at it and then misread the results. So they'll either be like, well, there's 100% there's going to be a site there. So, you know, we're not going to dig there. And you're like, no, there's a high probability, but it's a bit like, man, you can explain it to gamblers. Because like, if you're like, hey man, you know, you're counting cards with like blackjack, and you know, the movies get it all wrong. So they always have it where like everyone wins every hand. But that's not how that works. It's actually when you're counting cards, you have a higher probability to win. So you win like, you know, 3 out of 5 hands as opposed to like 1 out of 5. And that's how that works. But, you know, with the movies, no one ever believes that. And unless you're really good with odds, you don't know that. And it's the same thing with site predictive modeling. It's not 100%. It's not something that you're going to be, yes, this will be here or this won't be here. It's again playing the odds. And so if you are going to be using site predictive modeling, it's good to understand where that makes sense and what sort of sites and what sort of project you're on. And you especially get it with, like, you know, certain states, certain countries, certain territories, depending on, you know, what country you're in, will have, like, you know, massive, you know, a full statewide or a full territorial wide or, you know, where province, wherever you are, model. And people will be like, oh, when you do a bunch of predictive modeling without actually thinking about the projects, because there are some projects where, like, a bridge needs to go where a bridge needs to go, regardless of the archaeology that is there or the road. And so I've seen people spend, like, tons of time on site predictive modeling. You're like, site predictive modeling can make a lot of sense when you can say move a project or move parts of the project around the archaeology. And if you have a fairly large project, but I've seen people, like, try to do site predictive modeling on, like, a 1-acre housing site. And it's like, no point. The house is going there.
That's awesome.
Like, you're not moving the house. You're not doing anything. And you're still going to have to excavate anyway. So you don't need to do site predictive modeling. But conversely, I've also seen massive, you know, road projects out in the middle of nowhere, you know, government land, they own everything from one horizon to the other, as far as you can look. So, like, moving a dirt road is super easy. Like, you're just, you know, it's a support road for a bigger project. It's really easy to do. And they'll be like, no, we don't need site predictive modeling. And you're like, this could save you guys a ton of money because you're sending your road right through what's, you know, probably a high probability for several sites, and they won't do it. So that's where I'm going to go with site predictive modeling. Is one is, you know, you need to actually think of the business case for it. And that can make a lot more sense than actually the archaeological case.
So, you know, I think for predictive modeling, so I went back for a second MA in GIS and did predictive modeling. I really do wish I had called it probability modeling, but there are states, like you were saying, Doug, that have these probability models. One of my pet peeves with that is that they don't update them. Like, they've created this probability model years and years ago, and the purpose behind having the database and having everybody turn in their findings is really should be partly to update these models. Like, you have more data. The models are only as good as the data that is inputted into them. And so that's the one for me, a biggie, is not having these models updated. And then the other is making sure that they're done properly. Some states really put a lot into them and they decide whether or not a study needs to be done, all based on that probability model. And, you know, I think as consultants, one more thing, this is a theme that we're going to string through this episode, is that's up to you as a consultant, not just to say, you know, the agency says, oh, you have to do this. I've had multiple times where I had a SHPO that said, you have to, you know, do this type of study. And I came back to them and we were able to find through some research that it's not useful. And we've been able to, you know, coordinate with the SHPO and they have backed off on their requirements. So that's your responsibility as a consultant to make sure that you're advocating for your client in a ethical way. And sometimes that means that what the SHPO is asking for, which, listen, they have so many projects that come across their desk, they can't do that deep dive. That's your job. SHPOs are counting on you to do that background research. And if you come across something that demonstrates that whatever technology that's being asked just doesn't make sense, that's your job as a consultant to make sure you bring that up.
I was also going to say, sort of the flip side is, I've seen this happen, is where people will say, oh, the predictive model says there's a low probability of archaeology, so we won't do any archaeology there. And that's, again, abuse of the modeling. You definitely need to get those negative results, as Heather was talking about, to update the models. But what probability model is really good for is estimating work. It's not to say that the archaeology is there or to say it's not. It's saying there's a probability of it being there or not being there. And that helps you plan and budget. that's what they should be used for. But I have seen them abused with them being like, well, predictive model said there's nothing there, so we're just going to bulldoze through, not do any archaeology. And that is not, that's not how you do good predictive modeling, because you need those negative results to say, yeah, actually, we've dug here. It confirms or disproves the modeling by saying that there's nothing here. And you need that. And you can suggest maybe lower intensity work, or, you know, there's less likely of finding sites here, so we can go faster, or we can maybe use a different method that will go a bit quicker, because you don't, you know, your likelihood's lower. But likelihood is not, it's not a guarantee. So I'll end my predictive modeling rant with that.
Very good point. It does go the other way. And that, again, is your job as consultant, because, you know, as we know in archaeology, there's no guarantees of anything. Even if you did a GPR of the entire 500 acres, that'd be crazy, but I'm exaggerating, and you found nothing, doesn't mean nothing's there. So, you know, that's what you're doing, is you're trying to minimize the potential of finding something inadvertent, in it, having an inadvertent discovery that could potentially be planned for with, you know, good mitigation and training of the construction personnel. So, you know, you have a responsibility as a consultant, not just to find that negative, but to understand what the risks are, because, you know, of course, that's what the client wants. They want to hear nothing's here, or it's a low likelihood that you have something there, but they're sure not going to be all that excited if they do have an inadvertent discovery that waylays the project and causes a lot of costly measures and fees, because contracts with construction companies, if they have delays, there are fees associated with those delays, hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes, depending on the project, per day. So, you know, these, if you're not doing your due diligence across the board, you could not only cost the client upfront, but you could cost the client, you know, down the road during construction.
So let's turn it on to drones, not just for spying on people. We're going to use it for archaeology as our ever-expanding toolkit for archaeology. In terms of technology, drones is the way to go when it comes to giving a bird's eye view of not just what's on the ground, but above. What I've seen drones be used in these like podcasts or like videos on YouTube, but we about like, oh, we're going into a canyon and this is what we found. But for CRM and academic archaeology or whatever, drones really help give you an eye view of like, hey, I can't get to that area, but maybe a drone can show rock art, pictographs, petroglyphs, what have you. And it really helps you understand the brevity of the landscape, not just what you see on the ground. So I do a lot of work in the West, and there's always potential for rock art, and there's areas where we can't get there. It's really dangerous. So drone technology is the way to go for our toolkits. And actually, it really lets us understand how the peopling of the landscape happened, or just like they went up there to do a soul voyage or whatever they're doing. But drones help in terms of just letting us understand the exact landscape of how they're going forward. Drones, I know it sounds scary to like understand drone technology. I mean, there's a lot of legalities within it. I think when you use it for CRM, that is a whole new different proposal that you have to say, hey, we're going to go out, but we can't get to certain areas, but we have a drone. We can do that. And it really like helps us like write better recommendations or eligibility statements within our field. I haven't personally used a drone, but I've seen some really good work out of it, because it makes me understand landscape archaeology altogether and just how people are moving on the landscape. And it's one of those things where it's like, do I really want to learn this type of technology? Do I need a license for it? There's all these different things you need to have, or even just where do you get the technology from? Like, well, who do you buy it from? What drone should I use? It's kind of like, all right, you got to sit down and really like think about it, because as Heather said, it's about the cost and why we're doing it. But if you talk to your clients and be like, hey, we want to get this area done, can we use a drone? You have to propose that to, you have to like sell yourself on like a project to be like, this is why we need it. And like I said, I personally haven't used a drone, but I've seen some really good work out of it.
I was going to piggyback off of what you're saying. As far as drone technology, a lot of times drones are being used for other purposes. And so you can use data that's already there. So they're used for biological surveys. They're used for several other analyses that are being conducted for the project. And so sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to be all that expensive. It's something you can just use the imagery that's already been created for another purpose. So whenever you do have, that's where, you know, working, especially if you're working within a company that has multidisciplinary, you know, consulting, bio, you know, that are aligned with archaeology or more aligned with archaeology, you can use the same data. And sometimes it's just a matter of a little extra analysis. So remembering that these technologies as consultants, it's important to really have a good sense of what's being done for this project across the board, not just from an archaeological perspective. And if you're the consultant as an archaeologist, you're coming in and you're just solely, your company is only doing the archaeology, that is important to connect with the other analyses and understand what other technologies might being used for the other studies. So that way, you know what you can work with. I mean, maybe drone doesn't make sense. You don't think you're going to get a lot out of it, but you know that they're doing some drone, they're getting drone imagery for another purpose. Might as well ask to see if you have that capability in-house to ask and see if there's something that, you know, if you can have access to that imagery and you can look and see if there's something that is helpful from an archaeological perspective. And with that, I think we're going to take ourselves to the next segment. We'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 327. We're in our third segment, and we're going to have the pleasure of listening to the Andrew monologue on underwater archaeology, or whatever else he wants to talk.
Yeah, finally. I know my flock who's been waiting to hear my melodious voice. I am so sorry that I was silent.
Where's your crown and scepter, Andrew?
Here it comes. Here it comes. I'm going to lay some knowledge on you, people of Earth. So, you know, seriously, I love talking about technology in archaeology because I think it's fascinating. I think it gets very philosophical very fast. And because underneath it all, like technology, You need the right tool for the job, right? And notice I didn't say the right complex tool for the job, right? You need the tool that works. And what I find is a lot of times people get this like modern complex technology and it's too complex, right? Complex technology is expensive and it's going to break. And it might not even truly give you what you want, right? Because you have to think, and I swear, I know this sounds silly, but you have to think deep. Like, what do you want? What do you want at this archaeology site? You know, and I think, at least for me, 9 times out of 10, you want stuff like a good map. I want a good map of this archaeology site. And if I'm doing excavation, I want artifacts that are well recorded from the archaeology site. That's it, right? You don't need to like get the latest technology and spend a ton of money for something that honestly is often not as good as old school technology. And I have to say this, I am not some weird Luddite guy, right? I am not like, oh, technology's scary. I've seen this happen so many times where people bring in really complex stuff and it just goes to shit. Right. It just looks crappy. It's not as good. And they do this whole thing. Like, here's one of many. I am not the hugest fan ever of GIS. Oh, yeah. Oh, I said it. And specifically GIS maps. And because I find that they lose a bit of the human aspect to them. And the GIS maps kind of suck. Like, they don't look that great. They're obviously barfed out of a computer. And everyone goes, look, GIS. And it's like, okay, but we're forgetting the basics of we need to make a map that shows topography and shows where sites are and makes it like available for human consumption. See, like I swear there's something I see. And again, I'm not here to say, and therefore we need to never use GIS. Or, you know, no, I'm just saying like, don't just use it for GIS sake. right? I've seen technology in so many ways. Like, I'm not a huge fan of the Apple Watch because you need to charge it and all this kind of crap. Buy a $20 Casio watch, right? It will get you home on the archaeology project. Heather had said at the top of this that I could talk about underwater archaeology, and I can. Of course, there's a ton of technology there, and I'll swing back to on ground stuff. But the same rule applies. Like, if you're going to dive on an underwater archaeology site, do you want to use complex mixed gas? This is where you have different kinds of gases in your tank that is very expensive, extremely hard to bring out to remote sites. Or do you want to just use old school diving technology that is tried and tested and works, right? I'm a fan, even in diving, I'm a fan of snorkeling. And I know that sounds hilarious. You're like, snorkeling? You mean holding your breath? Yeah, a lot of times because you need the right tool for the job. What if the underwater archaeology site is only 5 feet deep or 8 feet deep, right? Are you going to bust out all your like scuba stuff? Or are you just going to get a tube to breathe out of, hold your breath a bit and take some good photos and deal with it, right? I've used a snorkel on underwater projects several times. And every time the other divers are like, damn, that's a good idea. And they bust out their snorkels. They ask to borrow like my stuff, like my snorkel and stuff. I'm like, that's cool, right? So I'm almost giving you guys a commercial for simple technology. Another one is like using GPS. I was just out at an archaeology site yesterday and my GPS, the batteries weren't working that great. I had decent batteries, but the connectivity was kind of sucking, and a compass works better than GPS. It does. If you have a compass and a good map, like you can draw a better map than having some GPS unit where it just records points every 5 seconds. You just have like technological crap. And again, I'm not here to say, oh, therefore never use a GPS. I'm saying don't forget your compass, right? And I think we really forget this. We forget how good you can make a map if you have like a base map, like a 1 to 24,000 base map, just rolling old school. You can make excellent maps. I find that screens are replacing paper too much. And again, I get it. Like, I get using like an iPad for some of the daily paperwork and stuff, but man, I gotta say, I prefer the paper stuff. I know it's a bitch. I know it's a bitch to scan, you know, but I think you often get a better product. I know some people would disagree, but that's mine. We can even think of like photography versus a drawing. People with iPhones, they're like constantly taking photos. Oh, don't worry, I took 1,000 photos of the site. I'm like, yeah, there are 1,000 crap photos. I need to see the stratigraphy, back to the basics. I prefer a drawing. I'm not saying don't take a photo, but I'm saying definitely draw some of that stuff. Back to the underwater world, a couple of technological things I've seen that do work that I would really double down on. Renee brought up drone technology. I've seen good luck with that, but I'm in total agreement with Renee. Drone technology is really hard because it's ever changing. And you're like, which one do I buy? Wait, oh, wait, we have the model from 2 years ago. You know, I find that with drone technology, you should just go for it. You know, if somebody has one, you're like, hey, just try it out. What do you get? That can be really worthwhile. And I will say that LiDAR technology, this is the full-on satellite scanning stuff, or LiDAR is often from an airplane, but you guys get the idea. Making a map underneath the jungle canopy, that LiDAR is great, but it is expensive as hell. It is thousands and thousands of dollars, but the map is very good. Still, you have to ground truth it. You cannot just get a LiDAR map and be like, site's done. That is not how it works, right? You have to be in tandem with regular human beings. I find that technology is sometimes used as a buffer for real knowledge. And what I mean by that, I was watching this yesterday with my students. We were out in the boonies and we had our 1 to 24,000 maps. And if you're just GPSing it, you don't have to actually know the geography or the topography. You're just recording numbers. But I had my students do it the old way, and I saw them really understand the landscape. I saw that they really had with their 1 to 24,000 map, they could see where exactly we were on the map. They could see like, this is the, oh, this is the finger ridge that we are standing on. And when you have that knowledge, then you really know where you are. And then you can start from there to make a really good map. And that is the major portion of my rant in terms of technology. Oh, I have more, though. But I see that Renee has something to say. I can't believe Renee would want to break in. Renee, what's up?
I'm sorry I'm interrupting the great Andrew Kinkilla on his.
This is very hurtful.
I'm sorry. Deal with it, as you would say.
Exactly.
Would you feel like, okay, we're talking about old technology, well, technology, but yeah. Hand-drawn maps, all that old school, like, that those are skill sets that are needed. Now, if technology fails and we're out in the field, how are these people going to actually interpret a site, make a map? Are we losing those soft skills of like actually understanding landscape topography? Like, we rely so much on technology now that we kind of like, we lost those skill sets. So how do we go forward with that? If when we lose technology, we don't have the satellites or Wi-Fi or whatever, how do we go about that?
Yeah, it's obviously, as you know, it's teaching these skills, and they're really not that hard to teach. And actually, they're also really fun. It's all that old school Boy Scout stuff, you know, and the students always dig it and they're straightforward. The part that I find that's a problem is generationally, we now have a generation of archaeologists who don't know how to do it themselves, you know, in academia. But you guys have all heard me on my various rants that they're all just teaching, you know, Marxist philosophy and how to turn an auger instead of like, this is the skill set. This is how to draw a map. This is what 1 to 24,000 even means, you know. So we need those skill sets. And you're right, because how many CRM projects have you been on where shit goes wrong, right? How many? Mm-hmm. I'll answer for you, all of them. You know what I mean?
I would say like, I'm gonna plug you because I can, being a former student.
Yeah.
Learning
me.
learning those skill sets of learning how to make a map. You know me, I love making maps. That's just hand drawn.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we rely so much on new technology or what gets better in the field, but we lose those skills in the end, and you'll just stand around and be like, how do I look at the landscape? So I think there should be some tutorial of, you know, this is how you look at the landscape and draw a map, like, or something going forward in this new generation, because we rely way too much on our phones. But I would say, because of you and your survey mapping class, I gained those skill sets and I'm able to push that forward to, I don't want to say my field tech, that's too possessive, to the young adults coming up in our world.
No, that's fine. And also, you have that knowledge. It also helps everyone, because it helps if you're looking at the modern technology map, you can tell, because you have that mindset of how the landscape actually looks, you can tell if it's messed up. You know, you can tell if like, oh, what we've been recording for the last 2 hours is worthless, right? You know that because you know what it should look like. And it's that skill set. Again, it gets so philosophical, but it's like, it's that skill set of really seeing the landscape and being able to translate a three-dimensional world into a two-dimensional world. And once you know that, you know the right way forward, you know?
Just like what Doug said in the whole probability, when you're on the ground too, you kind of see, you're like, you predict it. You're like, this is where a site's going to be. This is where that. It's just like, you understand the landscape without the technology. You're looking in the perspective of the people that were on the ground. Like, where would I settle? Where would I go?
Right.
So you don't need technology to understand where people were.
Yeah. I remember doing that in the desert, where it was like, people always live where there's rock shelters, and you just look out on the landscape and you see a big ass rock. You're like, I think we're going to go over there, you know? And it's just, that's a simple example of just sort of knowing the landscape. And that's, you know, that's sort of what I see. It's so funny when I think back to projects, the ones that I find for myself that were the most successful were ones where we used old school technology. And again, not being a Luddite, like not just being like, no, we just use rocks and sticks. But where it was a simple economical approach, you know, that got it done. And it was great. I'm a huge fan of stuff like the auger, you know, like the augers are great, but they're real. You screw in this thing into the ground and dirt comes out, You know, it's not just the ground penetrating radar. Ground penetrating radar is great, but an auger's better.
True. Don't be mad at me. I don't like GPR. Sorry, people in the podcasting world, whoever's listening, I'm not a fan of it.
Yeah, I'm not either. Although Heather was correct. It works in really specific circumstances, but it's a perfect example of something that gets way too much credit because they don't talk about all the times that it sucks.
It's failed me. It's failed me on excavations, and I didn't talk about this during the GPR set, but during excavations prior to it, we had GPR go out and we had all these anomalies that popped up. Went to excavate right on top of the anomalies. What was it? It was iron. It was nothing. Failed.
See, that's a great story. So it was like, was it iron in terms of iron somebody had left in the ground or like a natural?
Oh, no, like, no. Like, so it's the West Desert. So it's on like the Escalante Desert, right? So it's in Utah. Mm-hmm. And that area is very, there's a lot of minerals in the ground, lots. So in a geological standpoint, they should have known that was going to happen. They're like, oh, well, there might be something here, but I'm like, not really. So it
perfect
that
example.
Was a waste of money. Here we are.
I think we're in pretty good shape. I think that's it. Renee, do you have anything left to add or say? Any last minute bits?
No. In closing, don't rely on technology too much. Always use your soft skill sets, the skill sets that will get you through any type of emergency. Use your compass, as Andrew said. Oh, don't use your phone. Things happen. Phones are not reliable. Just understand you can use your brain and a piece of paper and you'll be fine.
Absolutely. And I just think that, you know, the complex technology thing, you could think of it as just sort of icing on the cake. It's like the actual cake is your soft skills, like Renee was talking about. And then if you're lucky, if it's working, if the technology is not broken or too expensive, hey, you have this little icing thing that adds a little joy to your project. And with that, we will see you guys next time.
Bye, everyone.
Take it easy, guys.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.